Welcome back, and thank you for listening to Weeknight Mysteries podcast. My name is Yuras. I am here with my co-host, Rain. How are you?
All good, as always. How are you?
I'm good. Today, we want to touch upon a case about a missing reporter from the, well, basically the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We want to talk about Jodi Hosentrout's disappearance.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, you did this during the SMP days, right?
Yes, I have talked about Jodi's case in the past. Some of the details I had already forgotten about, and I had the chance to listen in to some other podcasts and do the research myself. And I want to kind of go over some information here, so shall we just jump into it?
Let's go for it.
Jodi Sue Hosentrout. She was an American news anchor for KIMT in Mason City, Iowa. Mason City is this small city in Iowa. It doesn't have a lot of people living there. I believe it's like 15,000 inhabitants. She disappeared in the early morning hours of June 27th, back in 1995, which was a Tuesday. So kind of middle of the week.
Yeah, typical work day.
Yeah, basically. Soon after, she told a colleague that she had overslept and was running late for work. Since there were signs of a struggle outside of her apartment, specifically next to her vehicle, Jodi is believed to have been abducted. However, extensive investigations failed to uncover any clues to her disappearance, and Jodi was declared legally dead in 2001. Jodi Hosentrout was born in Minnesota. She was the youngest daughter of Maurice Nicholas Hosentrout and Imogene Hosentrout. Jodi excelled at golf in high school and won the state Class A tournament. After high school, she enrolled at St. Cloud State University, where she studied mass communications and speech communication. Jodi Hosentrout began her broadcasting career with CBS affiliate KGAN in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, then returned to Minnesota for a little bit to work at ABC's affiliate KSAX in Alexandria, and at the time of her disappearance, she had once again returned to Iowa for her position at CBS affiliate KIMT in Mason City. Probably butchered a few of those news stations, but she was generally covering the morning news from what I understood.
Morning news. So this means she would wake up way earlier then, because I assumed that morning news would start at 5 a.m.
Yeah, so actually, even on the day when she disappeared, she was supposed to go to work by 4:30, or like 4 a.m., something like that. Or like even 3:30 a.m. in the morning. That's when she was supposed to already be at work, on the day when she vanished.
Yeah, so on the day she disappeared, she was probably taken, I assume, between those times when it was still dark.
Yeah, something like around that time. So let's talk a little bit about the disappearance in general. So the day before she vanished, she participated in a golf tournament. I'll talk a little bit about that later. According to Mason City resident John Van Size, who is a person of interest in this case, she then went to his house to view a homemade videotape of a birthday party celebration that John Van Size, this man that we will also touch upon, had arranged for Jodi earlier that month, because I think Jodi just turned 28 that month as well. So this is what happened the day prior. She, you know, was at the golf tournament and then later allegedly was at a friend's place watching a home video of her birthday party.
I vaguely remember this guy during your SMP days. I listened to your podcast, and if I remember correctly, this guy was sort of creepy.
I mean, I feel terrible for potentially like describing him that way because I don't really know that info.
Because,
mm-hmm. You know, we are just talking about what we can find on the internet. But yeah, I think I'll mention some of the details here, but I wouldn't necessarily jump to that conclusion immediately.
Suspicious then.
I mean,
was that a better word?
Also kind of not sure if it's that suspicious. I mean, obviously, we don't have the information that law enforcement has in this case, so we can't really say for certain. All right, so at about 4 a.m. on Tuesday, which was June 27th, the day when she disappeared, at 4 a.m., KIMT producer Amy Coons, so basically a woman who was the producer in the TV station that Jody was working at, she noticed that Jody was not at work yet, and she should be because, you know, she's going live on air by 6 or something. So she needs to be like early to kind of start preparing.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that this was not a normal case for Jody.
She apparently had overslept a few times, but she never missed like showing up.
Oh, okay.
So Amy Coons, the producer, called Jody, and Jody actually picked up the phone at 4 a.m. And Jody explained to Amy that she had overslept and that she was preparing to leave for the station. So at 4 a.m., we know that Jody is still at home, preparing to leave. By 6 a.m., 2 hours later, Jody had still not arrived. So Amy Coons actually filled in for Jody on the morning show Daybreak. But at about 7 a.m., KIMT staff called the Mason City Police to do a welfare check on Jody because she still hasn't showed up. And I think Amy Coons said that her biggest fear was that maybe Jody had slipped somewhere in the bathroom or something like that, or was in some sort of a, you know, situation where she needed help. So when police arrived at Jody's apartment, they found her red Mazda Miata in the parking lot. And there was evidence suggested a struggle had taken place next to that Mazda Miata. Her personal items, including a bent car key, were strewn about the area. And police reported recovering an unidentified palm print from her vehicle. So investigators interviewed at least 3 neighbors at the Hose and Schutz apartment complex who said that they had heard the screams around the time that she would have likely been leaving for work. In addition, a witness reported seeing a white Ford Ecoline van idling in the parking lot about the same time. Idling in the parking lot meaning that someone who was driving past that apartment complex reported seeing a white van that with the lights off. And imagine, this is around like 4 a.m. in the morning, so it's very early morning hour, so it's really dark there. And a van is just idling in the parking lot. So meaning that the lights are off, but its engine is on.
That's immediately suspicious.
That's suspicious, right? Investigators interviewed at least 3... Oh, sorry, I'm reading the same information. In September of that same year, 1995, the Hosentruth family hired private investigators from McCarthy and Associates Investigative Services in Minneapolis, who in turn enlisted the assistance of a Omaha, Nebraska private investigator, Doug Yassa. So these people, McCarthy and Yassa, appeared on several national television shows, including America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries. In November of 1995, they and members of the Hosentruth family traveled to Los Angeles to meet with 3 prominent psychics. This meeting was televised and served as the pilot for the Psychic Detectives television show. Although each show generated several leads, none resulted in concrete evidence or identification of a suspect. So just wanted to mention that. In May of 1996, so the following year, approximately 100 volunteers searched an area of Cerro Grotto County. It's basically a county in Iowa where Mason City is located. And these people, the volunteers, they left flags to mark anything that appeared suspicious. Each of these sites were then re-examined by law enforcement, but no promising evidence was located. And police and private investigators have conducted more than 1,000 interviews, but none have resulted in conclusive evidence pointing to any particular suspect in Jody's disappearance case. In 2003, findjody.com was created. It's a website. It has a lot of good information about Jody's case. It's actually one of the sources that I was looking into heavily when I was preparing for this, I guess, topic. So it was created by Minnesota television journalist John Benson and Gary Peterson with the goal to keep the case in the spotlight and for the website to serve as a clearinghouse for tips that might lead to Jody Hosentruth. And actually, if anyone has anything to report about the case, they can go to findjody.com and leave a tip. Because people running that website, they're going to be clearing those tips. So when new cases arise that appear to bear similarities with the Hosentruth case, or whenever remains are discovered in the area, speculation quickly leads to a connection with a missing reporter. However, no suspect has been identified, and all uncovered remains to date have proven to be from other sources. So when I say that no suspect has been identified, it's kind of strange because it depends on where you look. I've seen some posts on Reddit and some other sources online that kind of like provided some of the persons of interest in this case. And there's definitely something to talk about regarding like specific people involved in this case. But this is just what Wikipedia stated. And I also have some information that in early June of 2008, there was a bizarre occurrence where photocopies of the 84 pages of Jody's personal journal were anonymously mailed to the local newspaper. So this is 2008, so I reckon 13 years after Jody had already went missing, someone sent Jody's personal journal, photocopies of the pages from the journal, to the local newspaper.
Okay, immediate question. Do you think this is some sort of like a mockery to the police?
No, we have actually additional info who sent it. So the Mason City Globe Gazette, the newspaper, received the material in a large envelope with no return address on June 4th, postmarked from Waterloo. The original journal has been in the possession of law enforcement since the investigation began. Within days, the Mason City Police reported that the sender had come forward and was identified as the wife of the former Mason City Police Chief, although noting that the former chief had taken that copy of the journal home when he left the office. The police gave no motive as to why the woman had sent the journal to the newspaper. And this woman used to work in that newspaper as well, so maybe it was like giving them a tip or giving them something to write about their former colleagues. I have no idea. But that's so bizarre that someone 13 years later just sent like the journal photocopies.
Do you think it's possible that 13 years after the wife was probably like cleaning their place, found the photocopies of Jody's journal and thought maybe it was an evidence? The whole thing was an evidence and thought just mailing it back would help greatly?
Yeah, I don't understand how that works. I mean, some people found it strange that the ex-police chief even had that at his home, because you shouldn't be taking back evidence back to your home.
True, but it could possibly be the chief was a busy guy. He thought doing some more work at home would have been better, probably.
Yeah, potentially.
Like just an overworked guy.
It could be. Could be the case. Yeah, it could be the case. So in December of 2016, an opinion piece from the Northwest Iowa Review, retired state representative John Quaker of Sioux or Sauk, County, described his experience with the case as a member of the Iowa State House Public Safety Committee. I know, it sounds so complicated. So basically a guy who was working in the Iowa State House Public Safety Committee, this guy, John Kay, he suggested that the cover-up had taken place by the Mason City officials back in 2016.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that's something. Because there was some speculation at first about this, that maybe some police officers were covering this up a little bit.
How come and in what way?
I don't really know the details, and I don't want to get into it too much, but there has been some speculation that there is a cover-up by law enforcement in this case.
Interesting. Is it probably because of incompetence, or what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, but you know, Mason City is a relatively small city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think law enforcement don't deal with such cases on
such heavy cases,
yeah,
right?
On a regular basis. So maybe some sort of an incompetence could have been there as well. But we don't really know. We can just speculate. And in March of 2017, a search warrant was executed against John Van Size, the same person of interest, and they were seeking GPS data for two of his vehicles. Remember I told you about this. So John Van Size, years after Jody went missing, like 22 years later, law enforcement were still focusing on him. So that's something to kind of keep in mind. he was still a person of interest all these years later.
Could you tell me more about this guy?
John Van Cise? Yeah, I was actually going to get into it in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I have some more information about John Van Cise that I'll kind of share. Because he is the, I guess, main person when people bring up Jody's disappearance. He is like one of the persons of interest in this case. So since 2019, licensed private investigator Steve Ridge has been investigating the case, and there's a reward for any information that could lead to Jody's case getting resolved. So yeah, that's pretty much like the long introduction. Maybe it was a little bit wordy and a little bit reedy, but this is just, I mean, I just wanted to kind of provide some additional like background info on the case. We essentially have a reporter, 28-year-old, or sorry, I think it was 27-year-old reporter Jody Hosentrout, who was, you know, apparently just having a regular week, just a regular week in the summer, and she seemingly got abducted from the parking lot from within her apartment complex. And there is, you know, this case is very well known in Iowa State. And you can basically, I think, you know, if you would ask around people in Iowa, I think most people would, or at least people from the who kind of, you know, were working in Iowa, especially around Mason City back in the 90s. I think everyone would remember Jody's case. And yeah, just a big time case, a lot of different leads and a lot of interesting information surrounding the case. And I think I've read somewhere that at this point, even on findjody.com, they stated that at this point, after all of these years, I think any kind of information should be provided to the public at this point, like anything the public could get from law enforcement or from the authorities. I think this information should be released at least to some extent, or like some more, I would say, information should be released to the public, or the case should be like talked about a little bit more, because any kind of information, any kind of discussion is good at this point to kind of keep Jody's case in the spotlight. It's been 29 years now since, or 28 years that Jody has been missing. So, very long.
Yeah, way too long.
Yeah, I mean, before we jump into anything more specific here, do you recall anything else about the case or anything that's interesting to you? I know you want to talk a little bit about John Van Cise.
Yeah, mainly because if I remember correctly, he was kind of, okay, maybe creepy was not the right word to use. Suspicious. Out of everyone involved, seems to be the most suspicious one.
Yeah, John Van Cise has raised suspicion.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, he was a bit older, but
yes,
I can't remember.
He was 49. And Jody was 28.
Ooh.
But I mean, from...
Were they friends or lovers?
There's no proof that, as far as I was able to find, there's no proof that any of them had any romantic intentions. Mm. There was some weird things happening where allegedly John was sending Jody like unsolicited gifts. I think John had a boat that I think he called the boat Jody.
That's just odd.
Yeah. And John himself, he had recently divorced. He had divorced, I think, within a year from the date when Jody went missing. But he was allegedly seeing another woman at that time. Another woman closer to his age, I think also in Mason City.
Mm-hmm. So they could have just been friends, but at the same time, if you name your boat after me, I wouldn't think we're friends.
Yeah, it's so I guess that's why some people did find John Van Cise as a person of interest in this case. I mean, the fact that law enforcement was still focusing on him, back in 2017. And it was strange what he did back in 2017 when you think about it. So basically what he did was they ordered him to come back to Mason City to do a DNA swab and to provide, I think, fingerprints and things of that nature. But before they did that, if I understand correctly how the situation went down, they actually put GPS trackers on his two vehicles. Because they were hoping that, you know, and at this point in 2017, he was no longer living in Mason City. He was living somewhere else. So what law enforcement was hoping for, law enforcement was hoping that as John Van Size goes to Mason City to do a, you know, DNA swab and provide fingerprints, he would also, you know, if he had any kind of involvement with Jody's disappearance, he would also drive to a potential burial site or any kind of place where some clues could be generated from. So that's a pretty heavy duty, I would say, investigative tactic to use. And 22 years later, so it seems like law enforcement was still heavily focusing on John, even all these years later. What do you make of that?
I don't know. It just added more suspicion to him.
About John. Like, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Sorry for interrupting here.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that we don't have all the information that law enforcement has.
Mm-hmm.
And if law enforcement is looking at John and using these tactics all these years later, means that they probably have something more that's incriminating him than we even can understand.
Yeah, I mean, he was already suspicious. I am already, like, leaning towards that he's the culprit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I don't know. It's just pretty odd.
I mean, I'm definitely not leaning any way in this case, just because I looked into it. And it seems like there's a lot of information that is not known to the public. And there's actually a lot of other people that had been potentially incriminated other than John Van Size.
Yeah, but I just remembered Jody was a newscaster.
Yes.
So a lot of people knew her and a lot of people could have been stalking her. She was basically a public figure.
Yes. Actually, this is a good lead up to some of the information that I wanted to kind of present to you right now. So Jody's apartment, right? She lived in Key Apartments. It's like an apartment complex called Key Apartments in the building C in Mason City. Yep.
Immediate question. Do you think it's, since you know more about this, you probably searched through Google Maps about this location. Was it a fancy apartment? Because thinking about it, newscaster, immediately you're thinking in a fancy. She was living in a fancy environment, gated community probably.
It's not necessarily super fancy. I would say it's like...
regular?
It's a regular apartment complex from the Google Maps. And yeah, so that's the information I have on the complex, though, is that the apartment looked normal when law enforcement went in. Nothing kind of indicated that anyone was there with Jody that night or that morning. The only bizarre thing that they found was that the toilet seat was raised up in her apartment complex.
Yeah, but at the same time, we can't really think too much of that because maybe it's a habit of hers.
Potentially, but she was living alone. So I guess for them, they were law enforcement... had some info, were thinking, did Jody potentially had a male friend or some sort of a male person over that night? So that was the only thing that was kind of, I think, off about the apartment. Otherwise, everything seemed okay. So Jody was supposed to be at work at 3:30 a.m. in the station that morning. And Amy called her at 4 a.m. You know, remember Amy, the producer?
The producer?
Yeah. So it's still dark outside. Just want to emphasize it's still very dark outside at this point. So Jody was running late and her hair was still probably wet. And it's assumed that she probably intended to finish up getting ready in the studio. And as Amy called Jody... Amy did not report anything off about Jody. Like, she didn't report that Jody seemed to be stressed out or anything. Jody seemed to be normal on the phone call, act normal. Jody lived on the second floor at the Key Apartments in Building C. Her apartment faced the parking lot. Her home address was actually listed in the local directory. And apparently the whole area was really easy. Like, even neighbors, I think, said that it was really easy to observe Jody as she was working out from outside of the apartment.
Oh, that's just creepy.
Yeah, and then on top of that, her address was listed in the public directory. So I feel like what that means is that if you wanted to find out where Jody Hosentrut lived, you could probably look it up.
Yeah, that's pretty bad considering she's a public figure. A lot of thousands probably knew about her.
Yeah, well, that news station, from what I've looked into, it didn't really go that. It wasn't that big of a market there.
Hundreds then.
No, like thousands. Like, it reached like, I think like I don't want to like lie here, so I don't know exactly how much it reached, but you know, it wasn't like the big news stations in Minnesota. Like, if you're in like Minneapolis.
Yeah.
It was like a smaller town type of a news station.
Yeah, but at the same time, that means a lot of people could have known her. Well, maybe not a lot because it was...
She was well-known. In Mason City, she was well-known. She was a very well-known person. Even though she hasn't been in Mason City for a very long time at that point, she was a very well-known person in the city.
Well, and that's everyone pretty bad.
Everyone knew her. And everyone apparently really liked her.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, just one or two creeps.
Oh, yeah. She could have definitely had the unwanted attention.
Yeah.
For sure.
And the fact that her address was listed down everywhere and it was very easy for people to observe her. I don't know. It's kind of like a pretty bad case of security.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So to build upon that, barely any security measures were at the Key Apartments. Jody's apartments was very visible from the outside, as I've mentioned before. Someone could have been stalking her and potentially looking at her. There were no CCTV cameras there, and Jody herself did not have a cell phone because it was the 95. It was mid-90s. Some beer bottles had been lined outside in the parking lot. They were there a few nights before Jody disappeared. They were facing Jody's apartment. And that indicated to law enforcement that maybe someone could have been looking at Jody's apartment from that location, from the parking lot, and drinking beers. Because there were beer bottles, like, at the parking lot. And they were placed in such a location from which you could observe Jody's apartment.
A local drunkard?
That's all the information that we have. So just wanted to kind of add that. Investigators believe she was attacked from behind and she was getting inside of her car. I think it's due to the fact that her bent car key was found. So I think she had her car key inside of the car door and was potentially attacked from behind.
And then dragged away.
Yes. Jody's bag was not at the scene. So it's, I think, believe that she, well, as she was getting potentially abducted, she took the bag with her. No blood evidence was found on the ground as well. And it's believed that Jody was being dragged up to Kentucky Avenue. And Kentucky Avenue is this like one street that's adjacent to the parking lot. There's only one street. So it seemed like the car potentially was somewhere close to the road, main road, and that Jody was potentially being dragged towards the road.
Do you think the white van is somehow connected to this?
There could be some connections. I'll bring some more information in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement never found that particular white van, by the way, that was reported in the parking lot. And we actually don't know if it even existed or was there in the first place. So this white van, it was actually reported by someone, I believe it was a man, who was driving to work that day. He drives past that apartment complex every day in the morning due to work reasons, most likely. And this person reported the sighting a week after Jody's disappearance, after he had heard about the crime, I think on news or something like that. And there's some also information that you could also find online that a neighbor who lived across the street from Jody's complex also came forward and said that she saw a light-colored van parked outside of the building's entrance between 4 and 4:30 a.m. that morning, so around the same time when Jody would be getting attacked, shortly after the man driving by saw it. So, you know, the same guy who I talked about a little bit earlier, who reported seeing it as he was driving to work. So this neighbor from across the street said that the sound of a slamming car door had woken her up, and that's when she looked out the window to see the van. She said that she fell back asleep and she heard another door slam. And when she awoke again 2 hours later, the van was already gone. So this neighbor thinks that the slamming sounds that woke her up that night may have been the rear doors of the van's hatch being closed. So potentially that could be the time when Jody was being, you know.
Yeah, but no scream. She didn't hear any screams, right?
But there's other witnesses that heard screams.
Mm.
After additional interviews, another witness came forward and said around 4:30 a.m. that morning, prior to Jody's disappearance, she had seen a young black man riding his bike outside Jody's apartment while jogging, which she thought was strange for that time of the morning. It was very early. He then began to ride his bike beside her as she jogged away from the building, which she found unsettling. The next morning around 4:30 a.m., she was nearly hit by a car while jogging again in that same spot. The car's headlights were off, and it would have hit her if she had not jumped back onto the sidewalk. This witness jogged the same route past Jody's building at the same time nearly every day and made it a point to mention both of these events as odd. So some person on a bike driving around, I believe it was the day prior to Jody's disappearance.
Driving around at nighttime?
Yeah, like 4 a.m. in a bike.
That's way too early too.
It's a bit too early, right? And then another time when someone, I think on the same night when Jody was abducted, someone was recklessly driving and almost hit her.
Was this a busy street where the apartment was at?
You know, it's hard to say. It's really hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
I can't comment on that.
Because if it wasn't like in the city center, probably it's more understandable than if it was a little bit outside. Do you have any particular location? Do you have any specific location where the apartment was?
It's really hard to gauge because Mason City doesn't seem to have like a very big city vibe where you could pinpoint, like the most trafficked area. It was a little bit outside of the city center,
mm-hmm.
but it still didn't look too rural. Still mm-hmm. seemed like there was some activity happening, but not too much. I would say not that much.
Yeah, so do you think it was rural enough for a person riding a bike to be weird in the middle of the night?
Yeah, apparently, you know, since the person jogging.
Yeah, because if it happened in, like, I don't know, a big city like New York per se, it would be okay. It would be quite normal.
Yeah, I agree. So it was strange.
Mm.
Let's just put it that way. And now let's go back a little bit to the Okay, last piece of information about that night is that three separate neighbors came out and said that they heard a woman's screaming noise outside that time. So it's highly likely that Jody was...
That was her.
Yeah, that could have been her. So I want to talk a little bit about the white van. So I've listened to this podcast, Consult Podcast, and they were talking about Jody's case, and they brought up something interesting that I did not know before, I think. So they said that Jody made a police report about a white van stalking her 8 months before she went missing. So 8 months before she went missing, she made a report to police that she was getting stalked by a white van. That's the report. We don't have any more information on that, but that's all we have.
I mean, that's immediately scary.
Yeah, that's very scary. And then you think about that same white van, or like, you know, a similar white van idling outside of her apartment on the day when she went missing, potentially. If that white van was actually there,
I mean, who reported the white van again, if you could kindly remind me?
So, seems like there have been two witnesses. One was a man driving to work, driving past the key apartments, and he noticed that there was a white man idling. And another one, it was a neighbor, I think a female neighbor from across the street. She said that she was awoken two times during her sleep that night by sounds of a door slamming.
Oh yeah.
So we have two potential sightings. So maybe it's looking like it's a credible piece of information, this white man.
Yeah, I don't know. From the looks of it, it seemed like it was real, because two unconnected people, the neighbor and someone just passing by, reported it.
Exactly.
And it seemed to be connected to Jody Stalker.
I mean, that's something we don't know. We can only speculate. Like, but Jody did report a van stalking her.
It seems to be a massive coincidence if it's not, then.
Very, very massive coincidence.
Right?
If it's not, yeah. Which makes you think that maybe there is a connection.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the day before Jody went missing, because it's important. So as I've said, Jody had a regular day on Monday, June 26th. She was anchoring the morning news from 6 to 7 a.m. Normally, she would do the noon show as well, but that particular day, she was off to be part of a team of golfers. She was at the Mason City Highland Park golf course, and it started raining, so actually not much golfing was done. It was some sort of a charity golf tournament. So people just stayed inside of that, clubhouse. Jody returned home at around 2 p.m. She changed her clothes and she came back around 3 p.m. that afternoon to the clubhouse where the golfing was being played. She hanged out there and talked with people. She had a cocktail. Oh, sorry, that whole event had a cocktail hour, I think, and then a dinner. And then she mingled with people. And then she went from table to table talking to people. And then she left at around 7:45 p.m., and she told people at the golf party that she had to get up early in the morning for the morning news, so she had to go. So she leaves at 7:45 p.m. Jody told one of the people on her golf team that she was getting her phone number changed since she had been receiving some nasty phone calls recently. She didn't seem to be too concerned about them, though.
I mean, probably normal for her.
Yeah. Actually, when you think about it, for a very notable person within the community,
mm-hmm.
it's probably more normal to receive that than for a regular person who's on the low down. You know?
Doesn't mean it's right, but at the same time, it seems to be like not the most uncommon thing.
Exactly. And we don't really have a lot of information on what exactly those phone calls were. I think Jody didn't mention anything more than that they were quite nasty. So at 8:24 p.m. that evening, prior to her disappearance, Jody called her friend Kelly. But Kelly was not home, so I think Kelly was in Mississippi, so it was just maybe a childhood friend. So Kelly was not home, so Jody actually talked with her husband, Todd, who picked up the phone. So Todd is the person who talked with Jody on the phone that evening. And they concluded a phone call when Jody told Todd to tell Kelly to not call her back because she had
Wait.
Yeah, sorry.
I got lost for a bit there.
Okay. I'm going to try to explain. So Jody calls her friend in Mississippi, Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly's not home, but her husband, Todd, is home. So Todd picks up the phone. So Jody ends up talking with Todd for a little bit. And then she tells Todd to tell Kelly, his wife,
mm-hmm.
to not call Jody back because she had to go to bed soon.
Okay.
Now it makes sense. Yeah, sorry.
It's all good.
And that's all the information that we know for certain. What happened next? What happened after that 8:24 p.m. call and Amy Kuhn's phone call the next morning at 4 a.m. is completely unknown. But this is where John Van Size comes in.
Ooh.
So let's bring it back a little bit. what was happening prior to this Monday and Tuesday. You know, she went missing in Tuesday, early morning hours. But let's talk about the weekend first, and then I'll tell you how John kind of comes into the picture here. So Jody left town on Friday, the week prior, to go on a water skiing trip in Iowa City with her friend John Van Size and some of her girlfriends. She returned on Sunday afternoon. After Jody went missing, John Van Size and some of his friends showed up at the Key Apartments. He said that he was the last one to see her alive, or to see her in general. It's unclear what exact wording he used, but some online speculation is saying that he said the last one to see her alive, which is a very strange thing to say to a person who's been missing for a couple hours, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So he was there at the scene, basically. He was living like only 10 minutes away, so I guess it's somewhat understandable. And he said that Jody was at his apartment the night before, watching a 18-minute video of a surprise birthday party that he had arranged for her and hosted for her. I believe in his home, maybe? I don't know. Law enforcement told him to get that video and come to the station. They questioned him, and since then, he was on law enforcement radar as one of the persons of interest. So this is where things are kind of hazy, because I think it's not certain, at least to the public, if Jody actually went to John's place that night. Because she was talking to Todd, you know, the husband of Kelly, her friend from Mississippi. And she told Todd that, you know, tell Kelly not to call me back because I'm going to bed, because I have to be up early in the morning. And why would she go to John Van Size's place when she has intentions to wake up early in the morning?
I mean,
pretty strange.
But that could also be the reason why she overslept.
Exactly. That's a very good point. That could be the reason why she overslept.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know. Naming the boat Jody, throwing a surprise birthday party for her, surprising her with a video of that birthday party doesn't scream really friendly to me.
Yeah, potentially, right? Mm-hmm. There is nothing other to support the claim that Jody was at his place the night before other than John Van Size's statement. And he lived 10 minutes away, so maybe he called her on the landline and maybe he said, yo, I just got the video. Come check it out. Come to my place and check it out. Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, and considering he was only 10 minutes away, it probably was just easy. Maybe Jody just went there just to check it out really quickly, maybe less than an hour, and went back.
Yeah,
it's not a big trip.
It's potentially not a big trip, yeah. So it's nothing strange. Honestly,
yeah.
It's just a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So John Van Size said that he was out for a walk that morning when Jody went missing. So now we're going to be talking about his alibi a little bit. A friend of John Van Size's testified at 6 a.m., this friend, a female friend, called him to make sure that their walk was still on. He sounded a little groggy and agreed to go for a walk at around 7 a.m. So I've seen different sources say different things. One source said, or at least indicated, that his friend called him on the landline phone from within the... So, you know, if it's a landline phone, so obviously John had to pick up the phone at 6 a.m. And let's remember that Jody probably went missing around 4:30-ish. And so someone claims to have called John at 6. So the window of opportunity for John Van Size to be involved in Jody's disappearance is only an hour and 30 minutes when you think about it. From 4:30 a.m. to 6 a.m., that's an hour and 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
potentially, if we are going to believe this alibi that has been provided for him by a friend, a female friend. So this female friend was actually someone who would go on walks on a regular basis with John.
Like, how close are women to John?
I guess he just was a guy who had a lot of acquaintances in Mason City.
And naming his boat
Jody.
Jody.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see how that could be the case. You know, he had divorced just a year ago, and he was maybe like
with regular walks with another friend,
yeah,
another girlfriend.
I can see this happening. I don't see it as like very, very strange. Like a guy, 49, recently divorced. You know, he was a salesman. Mm-hmm. He was selling corn seeds, I believe, something like that. So mm-hmm. he was like a corn seed salesman.
Okay, regular walks with a girlfriend. It's not weird at all, but just naming the boat. It's just so odd.
Yeah. Okay, so some more information for you, though. Someone had the parent. Okay, so some more information that... okay, let me just get a sip of water and I'll tell you a little bit more information.
Authentic water break again.
Oh, I needed this. It's a lot of details in this case. I'm just trying my best here to kind of provide this info. So I have some more information about something that would, legitimize John's claims that Jody was at his place on that day. So let's bring it back a little bit to Monday again. So this is, you know, Jody disappears Tuesday, early morning hours, around 4:30 a.m. But on Monday, someone had seen John Van Size at a bar in town where Jody and some of their friends frequented. A witness said that John Van Size came by that bar around 5 or 5:30 p.m. that evening. So remember, at this point, Jody is still at the golf tournament slash party in the country club. And John said to this witness that he had just gotten a hold of the copy of the birthday party video. The video was shot by a businessman's wife who was a friend of John Van Size. And he was apparently very excited about that video. So this piece of information, this sighting of John the day prior at a bar talking to someone saying that he just got this video of Jody, kind of strengthens the, or like let's say legitimizes his claims that Jody was at his place that night because he just got in the video. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that maybe if he was so excited, he would just call Jody,
yeah,
and ask her to come by, mm-hmm, and take a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? It legitimizes it.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't sound very suspicious.
Yeah. And so that's something that we have. And additional things that I want to mention is that the relationship between John Van Size and Jody wasn't fully known. I think Jody was asked by some of her friends at one point, like, oh, are you doing something more intimate with John? And I think Jody said that they're just friends. And I think John also didn't necessarily indicate to anyone that he was really romantically interested in Jody, other than, you know, the unsolicited gifts and everything. But, you know, maybe John was just the type of person who wanted to have like a famous friend in town. You know, Jody was basically like a famous person, yeah, in the towns. Mm-hmm. And John did seem to be like he was well connected in Mason City. So maybe he was just someone who was out to get that, you know, like to have like friends in high places type of a mentality.
That's true.
So I could see that happening. Nothing bad about John Van Size was found in Jody's journal, other than Jody saying that she was hanging out with John and they went water skiing. Nothing more than just being friends. John was 49 and had previously lived in the Key Apartments. He was known to the people in the complex, which is interesting because if he was the one snooping around the complex that night, someone would have noticed him because he used to live there previously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much, I'm looking at my notes. Do I have something more on John Van Size? Nothing that I had not mentioned yet. Other than, according to a Reddit post, John was driving a blue van at the time, not a white van. So something different.
Yeah, but it's so easy to rent a white van.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, that's just a detail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's what we have on John. So I don't know. Do you have any more questions about John? Because I knew you wanted to talk about John. Well, I gave you like a big load of information here about John Vincennes. And yeah, you want to react to it or reflect?
Okay, probably I'm not as suspicious of him as I was initially. It is quite weird for him to name the boat. That's like the weirdness for me. Name the boat after Jody, but at the same time, he's going on regular walks with another friend who was a girl and they kept on hanging out together. Maybe that's just him. I don't know. Maybe he's just a pretty odd individual with a lot of girlfriends.
You also have to think about it. He was 49. He had recently divorced. Seems like he's doing really well for himself. He has a boat. He had just recently bought a house. So he has some money coming in. And looks like a well-connected person. So I don't think he was a regular individual to begin with.
That's true.
He was not an everyday person. He was more of a outgoing type of a character in my eyes. The way I understand John Vincennes, he's more of an outgoing person. So he's like, I'm not saying he's innocent, especially since 22 years, law enforcement were planting GPS trackers in his vehicles. So I'm definitely not saying that he's innocent or that he should be overlooked. I'm not doing that. But I'm just saying that the way I understood John was like a different type of a person. You know what I mean? Like he was a salesman. And you know, a salesman has to like talk to people, interact.
Yeah,
he seemed like he was a very extroverted.
Mm-hmm. But do you think he gave the same attention to everybody else? Or do you think he had that special kind of attention given to Jody?
Seems like he had that special attention for Jody, especially all of the other stuff that kind of came out that I don't want to bring up in this podcast, but there's some other strange, bizarre details. I don't want to even mention them because I think they're very speculative. There was an incident at a bar with him where someone else was apparently dancing with Jody and he shoved that person away and saying, "That's my girl," something like that.
Ooh.
But maybe they're drunk. Maybe it's late. We don't know the context.
Yeah, but even if you're drunk.
Sorry?
But even if he's drunk, if that really happened, then he wasn't viewing her as a friend. I don't know, like the gifts alone.
Yeah, I could see what you're saying, but I would say it's very speculative. Mm-hmm. And I would like to focus only on like the details.
Yeah.
But there is like a lot of this kind of other stuff happening with John.
Mm-hmm.
That people are like, you know, trying to dissect for sure.
Do you think it could be a case wherein he had a special thing with Jody, but then it wasn't reciprocated?
Well, that is the main speculation. That would be the main motive for John to be involved, according to people online. That is the main motive that people bring up when they talk about John.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious.
That would be the main motive or that happened?
That could have happened, actually. I don't know. Maybe something happened that night. The night where when he showed Jody that surprise video.
Yeah, that's when people are... That's the thing that people are focusing on. That alleged time. Which we don't even know if it was real. Because some sources claim as if it really happened. But I've listened to a podcast where one of the people running findjody.com were talking. And they said they don't even know if it really happened. Because I think the case files have not been released to the public. So a lot of this is speculation.
And what about that statement he said? He was the last person who have seen Jody alive?
Once more, it's not debatable
sure.
What he actually said. I don't know what he actually said, but that's something that is mentioned online. You can see, you can find sources.
But he didn't specifically said that word alive, or did he?
Well, that's the thing. We don't know.
Mm.
We don't know what he said.
Interesting.
And I don't think anyone was actually recording him at the scene. So we, you know, no one really has any proof, I guess.
Do you have any, like, based on your research, did you read any articles expressing John Van Sice's reaction to Jody missing? Was he worried? Was he nonchalant about it?
So it's kind of strange. I don't really know how he ended up there in the morning, right? It's pretty bizarre that he was there as the crime scene was still being investigated. I think somewhere it was mentioned that John noticed that Jody was not on the morning news. You know, because Jody's always on the morning news. And now she's not on the morning news.
Mm-hmm.
And someone is filling in for her. And then, you know, since John claims that Jody was at his place the night before, it kind of makes sense to me that John would just, oh, wait, Jody was at my place. And now she didn't do the morning show. Maybe she overslept. Oh, man, maybe I'm going to go check up on Jody. So I kind of could see that happening, you know. I really can.
Well, maybe it was a morning person. So potentially.
Yeah, potentially.
I don't know, just from these stories, these statements, the amount of attention he gave Jody seemed to be excessive.
Yeah, it's been described that way, you know, but it could be like someone's really painting a bad narrative for John Van Sice. And yeah, I mean, it's so hard, and that's why I don't want to speculate too much about John Van Sice's involvement, is because a lot of the stuff around him is very like circumstantial, and you could just find someone creepy and you could like blame them for being creepy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, he was a bad person and did something bad to Jody. And on the other hand, even Jody's journals didn't have anything bad about John. Jody's journals, apparently, she wrote in her journals that she felt like she was outgrowing the town a little bit and she wanted to move on to a bigger market for her broadcasting career. But there was nothing mentioned that Jody wanted, like felt any kind of fear from John. John was mentioned as a friend that they were hanging out with. And from all accounts, Jody was having a good time with John. There was nothing that I've seen online that indicated that John was being a creep or was making Jody uncomfortable. Or maybe I didn't run into a source that claimed that, but I didn't find anything like that. So immediately focusing on John, I could see why, especially given the fact that 22 years later, law enforcement was placing GPS trackers in his vehicles, which is so strange. But other than that, with the information we have publicly, I definitely wouldn't just, you know, from the information that we have publicly, I wouldn't say that John 100% like is responsible.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't, you know what I mean? If we had something more from the case file that would implicate him, we could speculate in that direction a little bit, but at this point, I just don't see it.
Yeah, he could have been innocent, but at the same time, we have to admit that the attention given was not friendly. It was more.
Yes.
Would you do the same thing he did to a friend who was a girl?
Think about it. He is someone who just recently divorced.
And so he was looking for 49. A new...
Yeah, he was looking for anything probably, you know? Friends, girlfriends, whatever, you know? I'm just having a good time right now. I just bought a boat. I'm just buying a new house. I got some money coming in. I'm just outgoing. I'm going everywhere. I'm hanging out with people. I feel like that was John's like day-to-day back then.
I don't know. It seems very suspicious to me. Well, okay. Not suspicious in a way. More of like, I feel like there was something more.
With John Van Sice, yeah.
Yeah.
But would you say that he's involved?
Possibly not. There could be a possibility, sure, of course. We're never ruling out that. Yeah. But he could also be innocent. But one thing I'm quite sure is that it feels like there is something more. Like he sees Jody as something more.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So only John knows that.
True.
So we can't really talk too much about it. But overall, so this is Jody's case. And it's been 28 years. And so the only things that really jump out to me is, well, obviously,
The stalkers?
The stalker that she made a report about 8 months leading to her disappearance. The nasty phone calls, which she didn't seem too concerned about. We don't know what the content of them were. Oh, and this is what happened also recently. This is on findjodi.com. I almost forgot. They released a new article from a woman who had a pretty strange encounter at the Key Apartments, Building C, a month prior to Jodi's disappearance.
Okay.
A former Mason City, Iowa woman claims that she was chased by a man she saw standing next to the Key Apartments building where Jodi Hosenschild lived barely a month before the news anchor was abducted in the apartment's parking lot. She said that she was 14 at that time, and it happened on May 25th, 1995. She was running home from middle school in the afternoon. As she ran by Building C at the Key Apartments, the woman claimed that a man called out and then took off after her. She said, "I went a bit down the path and heard a guy yell, 'Hey,' at me. I stopped running and looked to my right to see a man through a bit of trees leaning up against a building. He yelled at me again and then started running right towards me. I turned around and then ran up a hill back up to Kentucky Avenue. I kept running next to the next corner where you can turn left to go to the pool. My friend lived in that house near the corner. I ran up to their back door. It was unlocked and I ran inside. The guy had stopped chasing me once I got up to the Kentucky Avenue, but I stayed inside and was looking out of the window, and eventually I saw him walk past. Just over a month later, Jodi Hosenschild was abducted from that parking lot in front of that same building where the woman claims she saw the man whom she said was never identified. This man who chased the 14-year-old girl had dark, shaggy hair. He was probably about between 25 to 30. He was white. The woman remembers that the guy was fairly short. He was wearing jean shorts. He had dark hair and had a tan."
Okay, it's pretty funny how you forgot this part out.
This is like the biggest thing that came out recently.
I was pushing for John Van Zijs so hard, but then this information came out.
Yeah. It's like something that I also noticed, like as the very last thing, because this information came to the public, I think, only last year.
Last year?
Yeah. Well, this woman, I think, contacted Jodi, findjodi.com, and told her story, what happened to her. She was 14 and she was chased by a man who was standing up, leaning up against Building C. But he was leaning at Building C, I think from the back of the building, in the like more woodish areas.
That makes it even worse, because it seems like he was
in the afternoon. Yeah, and this guy chased her. So the first thing that jumped to my mind about this particular sighting is that, yeah, it could be strange, but it could also be a situation where maybe the guy who chased after her maybe thought that the girl had stolen something from the apartment. You know, like she was stealing.
In the middle of the day?
In the middle of the day, because she was running through like these brushy type of a road, like woodish road, not like through like
the main
street.
One.
Yeah, not through the main street, but like through a road. And maybe he got confused, didn't know who this was, or maybe it was just a very strange person just leaning up against a wall. I mean, we ran into a similar guy just like a day ago.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember that? Mm-hmm. We also ran into like some guy, but this was like at night, standing up against a wall, listening to music, and just seemingly having no reaction, just standing, looking dead straight into the wall at an apartment complex. So it's a similar situation.
Yeah, but basically for the audience members, one night we, yours and I, we were walking in the middle of the night. It was 11 or 12, midnight.
It was midnight.
It was midnight. Yours wanted to go out for a walk. And then we were walking, and at one point, yours was like, let's go on this other path. We barely even walk here. And so we went to this smaller path, more secluded by the parking lot. And we saw a guy just standing, seemingly like staring in the wall. And then immediately, like, red flags, red ringing bells were... I heard danger. And yours was all chill, just walking.
I was like, this is like a horror video game or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That my reaction was... I don't know. I also felt uneasy. I'm not going to lie. I felt a little bit of a weirdness about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I was trying to set the mood to be a little bit less scary. That's why I was joking around. But I was also freaked out. I'm not going to lie. This just happened a couple of days ago. I hope that person is okay.
Yeah, it was just so creepy, if you remember.
Yeah, just a man standing...
Staring at a wall.
Staring at the wall of an apartment complex. We're walking through the parking lot.
Blasting music.
And the music was like very strange. It was like, it was like a happy dandy music. Like
upbeat disco-y, Russian-y music.
It was English. It was an English song. But yeah, it was a very strange encounter. So reverting quickly back to Jody's case. I think it could have been something like that type of
situation.
A similar
scenario.
Yeah, like maybe someone crazy. On top of that, Mason City had a meth problem.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, meth problem. So you never know. Maybe that person was on drugs. We don't really know. But there's information that came out last year that there was a man kind of chasing a 14-year-old girl in the afternoon months prior to Jody disappearing. That's bizarre. But, you know, the information is a bit different because it didn't happen the morning. There was no white van parked, you know. But it was still strange because it was the same building C. There's three buildings. And it was and the man was leaning up against building C. And he shouted, hey. And then hey again. And then started chasing the 14-year-old girl. I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, if the 14-year-old girl didn't stop and if the man actually got to her, just something in my mind tells me that things would have ended very badly.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been very bad. And I'm very happy that that girl got away.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very strange.
A very strange
outcome just a month ago. And you could find this information on findjody.com. The latest article, or one of the newest articles, will have that information. They even have a picture of the house and like circled in red, the area where the man was standing. And it's kind of this back of the house kind of area. It didn't seem like there was any need for a person to be standing there.
Maybe that guy was just smoking, hanging around.
Yeah, maybe, you know, anything's so possible. But then again, another strange piece of the puzzle. Yeah, so there's a lot of strange things that are connected to Jody's case. But that's pretty much all we have for Jody Hosenchurch's case. I don't really have much more to say. I wouldn't really want to speculate in either their direction either. I guess the idea was to just raise some more awareness. And someone actually asked us to talk about Jody's case. So here you go. We discussed Jody Hosentrude's disappearance.
Yeah, for me, before we end this episode, it seems like the security measures within that area was not the best.
Yeah, that's also, Jody is a very popular person in the city.
Mm-hmm.
She is easily visible through the outside of the apartment. Her apartment is facing the parking lot where there was beer cans. It just seems like someone could have easily been stalking her.
Yeah.
She had made a report about someone stalking her 8 months prior to her disappearance. There are strange people leaning up against that building just a month ago before her disappearance, chasing 14-year-old girls. It's a dangerous situation.
It seems to be a dangerous area.
It's a very dangerous situation, yeah. For Jody, it seemed like she was potentially in more danger on a regular basis than she would have even realized.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say. For someone like Jody, you know, you look at her working on the news station. She looks very happy. She looks like a very warm person, someone you could approach and talk to. And that not always works out in the person's favor, you know. You might not notice some dangers that are around you. Also, she was getting nasty phone calls. Just the list of bizarre things just keeps piling on.
Yeah, that's true.
In this case.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I would like to end this podcast because I don't really have much more to say about Jody's case. We might return here if there's some more information coming out on Jody's case. But at this point, I think we talked about everything, basically. But thank you, guys. And I hope you guys enjoy the podcast. And
let us know what you think.
Yeah, what do you think happened to Jody? And if you have any information, please go to findjody.com. All of the contacts of people to contact about submitting a tip are provided in findjody.com. Thank you for listening.
We'll see you very soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.